Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
This session was recorded on the 22nd of May 2013 at the Brecan Resource Centre located in Melbourne's CBD. In this session, Libby Oldfield, Director of Fitwise Physiotherapy, discusses why it's important to maintain good health, bone density and fitness as we age. We hope you find this session informative.
There are five areas that we really need to think about. The first one is our cardiovascular fitness, and I'm going to go through all these in more detail in a minute, but that's your heart and lungs and, you know, your general huff and puff. Bone health and or osteoporosis, and we'll talk about that more in detail. General strength, flexibility. If we don't have that basic strength and the basic ability to turn the laundry tap off or pick up the shopping bag or whatever, then our quality of life changes, and that's not necessary. You never meet a women's health physio without talking about good bladder and bowel habits, so we're going to go into a bit of detail there. And I'm not sure whether you've all been reading this, but exercise is very, very well tied to recovery after cancer and prevention of recurrence. There's a lot more emphasis now on, you know, when you start to exercise and how, and we'll talk about that as well. Okay. So general physical activity, you can write pages and pages and pages on all the things that just physical activity does. We're bombarded in the papers, aren't we, with all the things that we should be doing now. And for instance, the latest research shows that even if you go to the gym three times a week, if you sit still for 8 or 9 hours a day at a desk, you're actually doing more harm than someone who doesn't go to the gym but jumps up and down all the time and does stuff. So physical activity is tied to everything. It's tied to your heart and lungs, obviously, improves your circulation. We know it improves the function of your joints. We know it improves your flexibility. We know it strengthens your bones if you do the right exercise, and that's what we're going to talk about, strengthening muscles. But it's all these other things as well, using what we call your global muscles, which are your quads and your glutes and your hammies. You make a big difference to the way your body processes insulin. All right, so one of the reasons we are much more prone to type 2 diabetes as we get older is we become less active. So we're learning that we need to choose the exercise that makes a difference to that as well. We know it has a big effect on cholesterol levels. It helps keep them under control. Depression, huge. Okay, one of the things about exercise is you always feel good at the end of it, don't you? Even if you didn't enjoy what you were doing, you feel very angelic after. But it actually pushes your feel-good button in your brain that produces endorphins, which are those magic things that we need. Exercise and arthritis, huge again. Arthritis, you can't change the structural problems in the bones, but if you strengthen the muscles around the bones, you relieve the pressure on the joint. If you've been physically active during the day, you sleep better, and the fitter you are, the more energy you have, the more you actually can pack into your day, which is important, isn't it? All right, these are actually the Australian guidelines, just so that you know that they're thinking of you. You've got to think of movement as an opportunity, not an inconvenience. And in fact, my practice manager and I were chatting about that on our way down. She's been my little chauffeur today because she thinks I'm not well enough to walk. We have at our car park, we have a swipe thing on the wall, but to get to it, you really have to be exactly lined up, and it's in an old building. And we both laugh at all the people in our building who, you know, reverse and back and reverse and back just so they don't have to stop the car, get out, swipe it and get back in. So that's where it's an opportunity. You know, it's just that it's one of those little things that you do a couple of times a day. We know we should be trying to be active every day in as many ways as possible. Sometimes that's as simple as going by the paper instead of having it delivered. 30 minutes of moderate to physical activity on most days is quite a demand, and we're going to talk about that more in a minute. You need to pick and choose what you do there. Okay, so cardiovascular fitness is, as I said, it's your heart and lungs. All right, so it's the stuff that makes your heartbeat faster, therefore your circulation move quicker. It makes you breathe quicker because your heart's saying to your lungs, "Well, hold on a tick, we haven't got enough oxygen here. We need to be monitoring that." All right, so for most of us, most of the time, we don't do enough. All right, we're a bit scared of getting puffed. All right. Now there is an exception to that, and that depends on your health status and where you are in a treatment cycle, if you're still having treatment. All right. If your red blood cells are down, for instance, you haven't got the capacity to process what you need to do with an aerobic exercise program. So that's where it's good to have someone like us, or you know, somewhere else who knows how to modify the exercise according to where you're at. Okay, so it doesn't mean you can't do stuff, but it means that depending on what your blood levels are at the moment and things like that, we need to modify that a bit. But that sort of makes sense, doesn't it? If you haven't got the tools inside to deal with the increased oxygen demand, then you're just stressing the body to do it at that point. But that might be just today. It mightn't be tomorrow. It might be next week. So cardiovascular fitness does the obvious, okay? It keeps your heart healthy, keeps your lungs healthy. No point in surviving breast cancer if your heart's going to give up, okay? So that's obviously the part of the purpose of me being here today, is to talk about all the things that we need to worry about now that you've survived this experience. But as you well know, probably better than me, that you haven't just stopped living. You're actually heavily into living. So it's about how we can do this as well as we can. And we all need to worry about heart and lung fitness. As I said, the fitter your heart and lungs are, apart from keeping those organs healthy, you actually give yourself more energy. That's what fitness is. Fitness helps you get through your day. It helps you fit more into your day. It means you recover quicker when you do get sick. All those things. There's some really good research to show that the fitter you are before you have a bout of treatment, the better you recover from that. You know, sometimes you don't have choices there, but if you do, that's something to think about, or something to share with other people. And we also know now from the research that it makes you less likely to have a reoccurrence. How awesome is that? Just need to get into the exercise. That's the challenge. Okay, so what type of exercise should we be doing? I don't see anyone in the room that really should be running or jogging. Okay, now I'm going to explain all that in a minute. But, you know, if you're young, younger than us, there are some reasons why running and jogging should be good. Any sort of sport, you know, they're my favourite golfing ladies. But just walking, dancing, you know, they're aerobic activities. They make you hot and bothered. Okay, how hot and bothered? Does anyone know? There's an easy test for making sure that you're not overdoing it, or perhaps you're not doing enough. It's called the talk test. Okay, don't bother about heart rates. Heart rates aren't really that validated, even though gyms will tell you they are. The talk test is easy. When you're puffing, you should be able to string a sentence together. You know, gee, isn't that a pretty garden? Breath, all right? As opposed to Kathy Freeman post gold medal. She was having a breath every word, okay, but she just won a gold medal, that's okay. All right, but for you and me, it's about stringing that sentence together. So if you can do more than a sentence, you're actually not working hard enough. If you can't do a sentence, you need to back it off a bit. Does that make sense? So that means it applies to all of you at any stage in your life, whether you're in a treatment phase or not. That actually still applies. So it's really, really easy. So it's a classic invitation to take a friend with you, because if you're chatting while you're walking, you actually compound the effect of the exercise, which is also good. You know, you've seen all those movies where they have platoons of American soldiers going as they go running around. That's actually deliberately designed to make that exercise routine harder. All right? So you must be able to talk while you huff and puff. Now, there's one other nice little trick as well, and it's called interval training. right? An interval training means you do some really fast and then you have a really short break, and then you do some more really fast and then you have another short break. And the best research for that is actually out of Sydney, but elite athletes do this all the time, where you do 8 seconds of really, really hard and 12 seconds of steady. Now, that sounds very innocuous, doesn't it? But after the first minute, you'll be going, okay, but it's about doing that, all right? So you start off down here, heart rate normal, warm up for a couple of minutes, and then paddle along. The research actually says to do it for 20 minutes. If you're just starting out with that, you won't be able to do it for 20 minutes. It'll be too hard. All right, but that's okay. You've got something to aim for. You don't need a stopwatch. There are magic apps on the phone that you can get it to ding at you every time. But you can translate that into just a two-thirds, one-third thing, if you like, where you could do, you know, fences along the footpath. You know, I'll do two fences really hard, then I'll do three slow. Or slower, not slow, but slower. So you get your breath back. Just as you got your breath back, off you go again. Very, very effective. Stunning for weight loss, which is not always your problem, is it? But stunning for weight loss and for getting fit quickly, all right? And I'd be advising you to do that, say, 3 times a week. But if you're going to take this up, start with once a week and get good at that first, all right? And then when you're good at once a week, you'll actually start to think, oh, you know, that's not so bad, I might do that again. All right, so whereas I said before, the 30 minutes every day is actually a bit of a tall order for most of us. I know it doesn't sound like much. Hi. It doesn't sound like much, but, you know, you've got to set your goals at a realistic level. If you start by going every day, you're going to burn out and you're going to go, no, I can't do that, I can't fit that in. But, you know, once a week for 30 minutes, I could fit that in. And then if I like that, I can do it a bit more. Yeah? All right. So general fitness. So one of our problems is that once we get to midlife, things start to change. And some of you may have experienced your breast cancer prior to menopause and then found yourself plunged into menopause, which is even a bit harder because you don't even have the, you know, the couple of years of whinging about. You just sort of gone boom. So our most common physical complaint actually is weight gain. Right? Melbourne's actually the centre of the world for menopause research. They did a massive study with, I think they finished up with about 20,000 women over a 13-year period, where they interviewed some obviously prior to menopause, some during menopause, and then they followed them all through. So the Melbourne woman is 52 when she goes through menopause, unless she's had some experience that's changed that. And most of the whinging wasn't about the usual stuff, it was about just putting on weight. And, you know, a perfect example of that. You start to put on weight round here, okay? And that's Mother Nature's magic store of fat, because Mother Nature's panicking because you're losing your estrogen. And we store estrogen in our fat. So she thinks that if she puts on a bit more fat, that might work. Sadly, it doesn't. But that's a challenge for most of us, that sort of tummy fat. And one of the other problems as we get older is that our muscles actually become a little less lean, okay? So, you know, sadly, if you go to something like a leg of lamb, you can see in, you know, a lamb as opposed to a sheep, it just looks less fit. Does that make sense? It's still really good for you, but it's less fit. So the less muscle mass you have, the slower your metabolism goes. So that's the other bonus. We're going to talk about that with strength training in a minute. The more muscles you have on board, the more efficiently your body works, and you actually have a raised metabolic rate. So if you are worrying about your weight, sitting there in the chair with strong muscles, you're working harder than someone who's sitting in the chair with fat. So that's awesome too. So you're losing weight while you're thinking about it. Sadly, it's not always that easy, but okay. So these are just to give you some, you know, useful facts. Women who stay active throughout their midlife have more lean muscle, greater metabolic rates, which is that energy consumption, and they weigh less than their people who sit in their chairs. This is an interesting thing, isn't it? For every pound of muscle you gain, you burn 35 to 50 more calories each day. So if you add that up, that's pretty awesome. Okay, it's not actually hard to get muscle. I'm going to talk about that. It's actually quite easy to get muscle, and you actually love you love the feeling of being stronger. I find that that's the thing that we all get hooked on. Even if you think doing them is a bit boring, you actually just love the fact that you're toned up. And the other good thing about girls is that we don't turn into Arnie Schwarzeneggers or even Arnie Schwarzenegger at his heyday. You have to have steroids to do that, so in the illegal dose amounts. So girls just tone up. We just look better. Okay. Just a couple of research things for you. You will have these details, I think, but, you know, if you wanted to try and read a... Systematic reviews are quite good. They're the sort of gold standard research because they actually pull together a whole heap of studies and then compare them. So in our world, that's regarded as the gold standard. So if you've got systematic reviews that prove something, QOL stands for quality of life. Okay, so that's just showing that if strength training, which I'm going to talk about, actually improves your quality of life for cancer survivors. And then Sprod and his mates found that it led to better endurance for your heart and lungs, less tiredness, less symptoms of depression, and the longer you did it for, the better you got. Okay, which is in fact what happens as well. Okay, and just one more. And this one was really interesting too because it actually changed what you thought about yourself. So you looked better, you felt better, you felt stronger, you discovered you had some sexuality perhaps, and your relationships and social functioning were much better. You know, you weren't too tired, I can't be bothered going out, all those sorts of things. Okay, so all very good reasons for going down this path. Okay, so increasing your strength makes you far less dependent on others. As I said before, it's the little things like, you know, you thought the laundry tap was stiff, but in fact, as soon as you got a bit stronger, it was okay. Shopping, one of the things that we are very anti at the moment are the jolly green bags in the supermarket. I know they're good for the environment, but they're twice the size of a plastic bag, and by the time you put stuff in them, they're too heavy. And I'm going to explain why that is in a minute. But if you're just, you know, wanting to play with grandkids and be active and do your shopping, you're not actually going to... you're going to notice that you manage all those tasks much, much better. The other thing about performing daily tasks is that they're all in our lives. We've all got stuff we have to do. But if you're fitter and healthier, you're actually less likely to injure yourself. So one of the other problems that we have as we get older is that our connective tissue's not nearly as good. It's not as elastic, and it's easier to injure, and it's slower to heal, and, you know, it generally sucks. So it's about staying fit, so you are avoiding some of those things. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about some specific exercise. Now, we've done cardiovascular. Let's think about bone health. That's the last negative statement I think I have in these slides. This is just to show you how we do bone. Okay, bone is a living thing. We make a million new bone cells every day, and we get rid of about a million as well. So it's a total, you know, ongoing thing. But there are times in our lives when life is better. Okay, you're actually not born with good bone density because you haven't met gravity yet. And most of this research, interestingly, has come out of all the space stuff. When they first sent people up to space, and I don't know whether you saw, there's something on the telly the other day where somebody's just come down from 4 months in a space station and he's taken off the thing in a wheelchair because he actually can't walk. If you only go up for a few days, you're fine, but we are designed to be in a gravity environment. So if we take that away, all our muscles and bones lose their reason for being, if you like. And so when you're a baby, you don't actually have any reason for being either. Your first indication of gravity is sort of, you know, when you hit the air. So you start off with no bone density, and it takes us till we're about 25 to reach our peak bone mass, okay? In girls, we actually know that the first 4 years after you start to have your period are the most important. In those first 4 years, you do the most bone laying down. Sadly, if you think about what our girls do these days, they start to sit around, they become very aware of their posture and their body, and that's a time in their lives where they stop exercising rather than keeping on going. So if you've got young people in your life, they need to be playing a team sport or something, because if you have two training sessions and a match every week. That's it. That's all you have to do. But exercise of some sort, weight-bearing exercise, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. From 25, for us it's to menopause, and then we have this big drop-off, right? For men, it's much more a slower drop-off, and that's because our bones are actually governed by hormones, all right? So estrogen is the thing that keeps our bones healthy, which is why that first 4 years when you first get your period, that means you are producing estrogen, because you have to produce estrogen to actually get your period. And boys lose their testosterone, but not as dramatically as we do. Okay, so this is often talked about as a bone bank. Okay, so for the first 25 years, you're actually making more deposits than withdrawals. So if you think about that process where you're making your bone cells and you're chewing up the dead ones, there are more deposits than there are withdrawals. From 25 to menopause, your deposits and your withdrawals are pretty much the same. But post-menopause, your withdrawals are more than your deposits. So you finish up. We lose 10% of our bone density in that first year post-menopause. Okay, so that's sort of quite dramatic, isn't it? And it also means that you can find yourself with a problem without knowing that you were going to get one even. Okay, so we know for bone health we need to think about exercise, which I'm obviously going to talk about more, diet, and smoking plays a big part, but I'd be surprised if any of you were smoking. Yeah, no? Giving that up? Okay, so just to put it back into context, this is one of my favourite slides. I think this was made by a bloke. The seven menopausal dwarfs, so itchy, bitchy, sweaty, bloaty, sleepy, forgetful and psycho. All right. So the definition of menopause is 12 months without a period, okay? So that's problem number one, isn't it? It's obviously all designed by a bloke. I'm not anti-bloke, I live in an all-male house, but there's a lot of research in medicine that because it wasn't affected by bloke. Excuse me, I'm just going to cough. Okay. So, connective tissue is your tendons, your ligaments, all those sorts of things. Osteoporosis we're talking about. And you're more prone to heart things. They used to think that estrogen protected us from heart attacks, stuff like that, which is why there's always been so much emphasis on replacing estrogen. Okay, which we now know isn't a good thing always either. But for a while there, our heart attacks and stuff way lower than the blokes. And after 10 years, we've got the same risk of having all those things. Okay, so for connective tissue, as I said before, ageing means it's less elastic and it's slower to heal. So less elastic means it doesn't stretch when you, reach right out for something, and so you're more likely to tear it than bounce back. Around your bladder and your bowel, you're much more prone to structural failure, which sounds dramatic, but we'll go into that in a bit. Your vaginal wall changes, it really misses its estrogen, and that's a conversation to have with your doctor, because that makes sex uncomfortable usually. And topical estrogen is usually quite safe because it's not absorbed into your system. So it's different to having systemic estrogen, which I'm sure most of you probably told you shouldn't do. But that it would be a conversation to have if your vaginal wall's not all that comfortable.
You know that lady grabbing your shoulder?
Yep.
She's starting to get an ache, even last night I'm rubbing it and it goes up into my neck.
Well, that could be, it could be your shoulder, it could be your neck. You should really check that out.
Yep.
Okay.
I don't want to go down to the doctor
facility
things.
No, but you can go to a physio without going to a doctor. You don't need a referral to see a physio. Physios are first-time practitioners. So go to, ask your friends, find a local physio that everyone swears by, and go and tell your story to them. Okay? Chiropractors believe that every problem you have originates from your spine. So they mobilise your spine and, click it and do stuff, and they think that helps. Physios don't think that. Physios look at your whole body and sort of so they can mobilise joints. They do soft tissue stuff on your muscles and things like that. So, and then you usually are given stuff to to, usually there's a problem, like your body doesn't pack up just because it feels like it. It packs up because you're getting older or because you're weak in one spot or whatever. So the symptom is a sign that there's a problem, all right? And I guess the easiest way to think about that is a bit like the footballers. You know, they do a hammy on the footy field. Okay, so the first priority is to fix the pain and let the hammy heal. But they're not allowed to play footy again, are they, until they've actually got back to the level of playing footy. So most of us don't do that. Most of us go along, get the neck pain fixed and go, okay, that'll do. All right, whereas physios tend to focus as well on, well, okay, you've got the pain fixed now, but we don't want this to happen again, so how are we going to move it on? Osteopaths are sort of in the middle. They don't mobilise joints and they don't prescribe exercise, but they do a lot of soft tissue stuff. So, you know, everyone usually swears by somebody, and if that person's making you feel better, then that's what you should be doing. None of those people need a referral. None of us need a referral from a doctor. And often your doctor, like your GP particularly, has to be really much a jack of all trades these days, because everyone's got specialist areas. And like, it's a concern for me, because I can have one of you turn up and your GP's been listening to you tell them your complaint but hasn't actually done anything about it. Whereas I'm going, well, you know, if you said that 10 years ago, you should have been getting it fixed 10 years ago, right? So you need a good GP, and I'm sure you all have them, but it's about thinking, redirecting the traffic, if you like. But you don't need to always go and see a doctor. I mean, if you go to a physio, we're obviously a lot more conservative. We're not going to suggest an operation straight off. If you go to a surgeon, they are going to suggest an operation straight off, because that's their job, right? So it's about thinking about what's wrong. And I mean, I guess from our point of view, if you turned up with that and I didn't think it was something I could help with, or anyone in my staff, we'd be the first people to say, well, Joel, you need to go back to your GP. I think you need to go and see, you know, da da da, or have an MRI or something. Oh yeah, yeah. We're based up at the top of opposite the Fitzroy Gardens, just behind the St Pat's Cathedral. Yeah, you don't need to come and see me, but one of my staff, yeah, if you want. But our stuff's all out there, but you might even have a local physio that you want to see as well.
Yeah, I've had that problem. I just sat there and I said, I've got something wrong with my knee. Oh, it's probably arthritis.
You see, arthritis, I mean, the bottom line is you can't cure arthritis, but as I said before, if you know how to manage it and you get all sorts of tips on how to move and sit and you strengthen up all the muscles, you're going to manage your arthritis much better, and it isn't going to be a sore, which is also what you need. So you need
to have arthritis in the jaw.
Everybody has arthritis. It's a wearing out disease,
yeah.
Okay?
So I just thought it was all connected.
And look, yeah. Yeah. But it doesn't mean you can't do anything about it, all right? But one of the interesting things that's happening in the medical world now is they're actually doing studies on the effect that imaging has, okay? Now, imaging is really important if you've got cancer, because you need to know where it was and that it's not coming back and all those sorts of things. But you're actually 6 times less likely to get better if you have your back pain x-rayed. Isn't that interesting? And that's because the treatment isn't going to change just because you know what the x-ray says. And it's the words that the radiologist uses, degenerative spine, bulging disc, you know, it's every sort of negative word you can imagine. Whereas I'd pick up the x-ray report and go, yep, 75-year-old spine, that's pretty normal, this is what we'll do. You, the 75-year-old, pick it up and go, my God, you know, bulging disc, I'm going to be in a wheelchair in a week. So our perception of that information is very different, okay? So that's just for normal low back pain, okay? As I said, you know, you people have all been through, you know, the worst case scenario of, okay, I've had an image and there's bad news. So there are lots of reasons why imaging is good, but sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's not going to change the treatment.
Sorry, yeah. I was going to say, was that what you mentioned when you said it? I thought you were meaning that the actual imaging process
damaged you. No.
Damaging.
No.
It's just the
mental thing.
Oh, okay.
And we are very much governed by our heads with everything we do. Everything we do.
May not be learning that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, managing chronic pain is a whole other ballgame, yeah. Well, you see, then you panic and you think there's something wrong, whereas you're actually better to go and get it checked out. And it's probably just a musculoskeletal injury, okay? It's not going to be cancer every time, okay? But I can understand, absolutely. And yeah, and the only way you're going to get that peace of mind, though, is by managing that, isn't it? Otherwise you're going to sit at home and worry. And yeah.
Mm.
There's lots of good stuff you can do, but we'll be here all day. No, no. If it feels good, thank you. If it feels good, bottom line is exercise should make you feel better at the end of it. And we have actually, again, one of the problems that you have as you start to go through midlife and beyond is that you're probably not without some aches and pains, okay? So we have what we call a two-hour pain rule, so that if you do something, and like we also have to understand the difference between stretchy pain and muscles that are just whinging because they're doing something which is important, they need to whinge. But if that pain disappears within the next couple of hours, then that was fine. Okay, if you just go, that's uncomfortable, I'm not going to do that, you're never going to go anywhere, all right? You have to actually extend yourself. If you go for a run around the block every day for the rest of your life, it will cease to be effective because your brain just goes, oh no, I do this all the time, that's really easy. You have to keep changing exercise, which is where, and that's good because you get bored otherwise as well, all right? Okay, back to osteoporosis for a minute. Okay, this is a bit of a complicated word there, isn't it? Microarchitectural, but this is osteoporotic bone, so it's just lost all its structural integrity, okay? And that's because their bone cells aren't there to make it, all right? And one of the worries is that if you have a fracture, it sort of then wedges like that, and that's where you start to get that Dowager's hump thing, okay? So totally forbidden in our world. All right, so for bone mineral density, which is what BMD stands for, you've got lots of risk factors, okay? Genes, the first problem is your genetics. If your parents had osteoporosis or anyone in your family, you're actually much, much more likely to get it. And there's not much you can do about your genetics. There's a lot to do with your diet, okay? Most of us don't have enough calcium anymore because we've gone absolutely burko on keeping everything low fat. But in fact, low fat and calcium aren't related. So, you know, milks like Physical, for instance, that has no fat in it, is loaded with calcium. So it's about making sure that you're balancing out all your needs, not just, well, I'm not going to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things, again, for young people is that the girls who have dietary eating disorders actually drop their weight to the point where they stop producing estrogen, so therefore they start to affect their bones. And that actually doesn't recover. They finish up with the bones of a 70-year-old. Okay, whereas other periods in your life, like when you're pregnant and when you're breastfeeding, when you have low levels of estrogen, that recovers. Mother Nature copes with that time frame. She doesn't cope with what those girls do. And that's one of our community problems today. Lifestyle, it's a bit of not getting enough exercise or doing the right sport. Hormones, we've talked about. Basically, if you don't have estrogen, you're much more likely to get osteoporosis, and that happens to all of us because that's what menopause is. Right sort of exercise and other things. The things that you've come across perhaps as a premature menopause where you haven't had the, as I said, the 2 years of being able to whinge about things changing. But you're still missing your estrogen, which is the problem. The other things that go into this box are absorption things like, you know, celiac disease and stuff. If your gut isn't absorbing the right sort of nutrients from even the good food you're putting in, then you have a problem. So if there's a family history of stuff like that, it's good to check that out as well. Okay, when they diagnose osteoporosis, they do this fancy little, it's quite a pretty graph if you've ever seen one. Has anyone had a bone density? You must all have probably, yeah. Nice pretty graph. Basically zero is sort of the mean for the normal population there, and they measure how far apart, in fact this one goes the wrong way, in fact it's back to front, sorry about that, this one goes, so we're going that way, all right, so minus one standard deviation from the mean, if you think back to your schoolgirl maths, and then minus two, minus 2.5 and three. So normal, they measure T-score, which is measuring your score against a 25-year-old, and you think, well, yeah, that's not really fair, I'm not 25. But 25, remember, was where you reached your peak bone mass. Okay, so they're actually measuring what your score is now against where it probably was. So anywhere between minus 1 and higher, you're normal. Between minus 1 and minus 2.5, it's called osteopenia, which means your bones are thinning, but they're not actually osteoporotic. and osteoporosis is minus 2.5 and lower. And sadly, people come in under minus 4 and they actually stick osteoporosis plus increased fracture risk on that. All right. Why is it a problem? Look, 1 in 2 women and 1 in 3 men over the age of 60 years will have an osteoporotic fracture. Okay, 20 to 25 get admitted to a nursing home as a result of that. 50% don't recover their pre-fracture status. You lose your confidence. You die, which is really sad. And that's what it costs us. $2 billion in people in hospital. At the moment, once every 8 minutes someone gets admitted to a hospital in Australia with a fracture, and by 2020 they think that's going to be one every 2 minutes. Okay, and we don't have the hospitals to do all that, like when we can fix it, when we can... Okay, management, you should be talking to someone about vitamin D and getting your vitamin D levels tested, because vitamin D is showing up to be awesome for everything. Okay, so for surviving cancer, for staying well, fighting off infections, most of us have too low a vitamin D. They have raised the bar as well, just to be confusing, but... you need to know what your vitamin D levels are, and all other things being equal, you know, probably be boosting that, especially at this time of the year. All right. Yep. They're saying it's 75 millimoles. So if you just remember 75, okay, there is a thought, but there isn't evidence to back that up yet, that it should be over 100 to have its best effect. But most of us test around 40, even lower than that. This is the best time to get it tested, because this is the time in your year where your vitamin D should be at its best, because you've just done summer, all right? Whereas if you test it in spring when you've been inside the whole time. But the amount of sunlight we need is something like an hour every day in the middle of winter. Well, you know, you've got to hope the sun comes out first, don't you? And like most of us wouldn't get that, would we? So... The further south we go, the worse we get. And sadly, you know, the Sudanese refugees have chosen the wrong cities to land in. One of the things that alerted the medical world to vitamin D was the early Sudanese refugees started having rickets babies, you know, vitamin D deficient babies. The darker your skin, the more you need. So the really dark skin people need about four times what you probably, you and I need. And so, you know, if they're not taking four pills a day, you know, they're not getting the sun. So, and of course there are other issues there, like being covered up and all that stuff as well. And there's obviously a debate between the Anti-Cancer Council and the osteoporosis people about slip, slop, slap, because we've all got too good at the slip, slop, slapping as well. So I think the general consensus now is that you slip, slop, slap from 10 till 3, and before that it's good to not slip, slop, slap, unless you've got some other reason for... panicking about that. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Do you know offhand, like my doctor's told me I have to have vitamin D now. And when I went down, the guy said to me, oh, you can have this brand for much cheaper.
You can.
Is that okay?
For the same. Yep.
I mean, that's so much more expensive than what I bought.
Yeah, that's the brand name. That's like trying to buy brand name drugs. What you want is, so when the writing down here should say 1,000 UI, which stands for... Yeah, it's written as UI. Is it my U? No, 1,000 international units.
Yeah.
Okay, so one tablet should contain 1,000 of those. But they have to provide the same amount of stuff. It's like getting Panamax instead of Panadol. They're just cheaper versions of brand name drugs. So they're okay. Calcium is the one I wanted to really talk about, because 1,300 milligrams a day of calcium is a lot. It's four serves, okay? And that's for postmenopausal women, and that's the same as an adolescent male. Okay, that's the only time in your life you need this much calcium. And a serve is 250 mils of milk. It's 200 grams of yogurt. It's a matchbox-sized piece of yellow cheese. Sadly, not the Brie and Camembert, but the yellower the cheese, the better. It's a tin of sardines, things like that. There's calcium in most things, but you have to be a bit realistic about the volume. You know, like there's calcium in sesame seeds, which is great, and you can sprinkle them in your casserole or whatever, but you need 45 tablespoons to get a serve, you know. I mean, there are quicker ways of doing it. So if you don't like milk, there's soy-enriched products, all those sorts of things make a difference as well, all right? So it's about looking at what you eat and not being scared of the bit of calcium, because it's actually going to do you good. Weight-bearing exercise, that's what we have to talk about. Okay, and this is where people mess it up, okay? If your doctor says to you, walking, that's a weight-bearing exercise, fantastic. Yes, it is a weight-bearing exercise, but it goes back to what I said before. If you do something all day, every day, your brain doesn't think that's a challenge, so it's not going to do anything different. One of the things, there have been lots and lots of animal studies done about lifting weights and things like that. This is the original piece of research where when you load bone, you model and remodel it. In other words, when you make your bone blood, you make your bone cells, they get dumped and then they get shaped into bones. Anyone ever had a fracture? Yeah. When you first do your fracture, if you look at it on the x-ray, it's all, you know, it's sort of like one of those lumps on a tree. But if you x-ray yourself again in a couple of years' time, it's gone back to looking like a normal bone. That's the remodelling phase. So one of the things that we think about with exercise for bones is that you have to actually challenge the bones. They have to actually go boom and get a shock. All right, so the easiest way to do that is running and jumping, but as I said before, that doesn't really go into my list of things to do for you. So if we're not going to do it that way, we have to do something else that shocks your bones, and the next best thing to shock your bones is adding weights. Because if you add weights to the muscles are all stuck onto the bones, so when you put a heavy weight in your arms and your muscles, your biceps goes, wow, okay, the bits of bone where the biceps were stuck on also go, wow, all right? And that's how you get it. All right, so to monitor osteoporosis, you've got to exercise properly, and we're going to do that in a bit more detail, eat well, and monitor your other risk factors. All right, so strength training. That's what we're talking about, strength training or resistance training. Okay, they're interchangeable. Pure strength training is lifting the maximum weight you can once, all right, a la Olympic weightlifter, all right? But that's not terribly practical because you actually don't know what your maximum weight is until you can't lift it, right? So it's a bit of a scientific definition. When we do strength training for training purposes, we do the maximum weight you can lift up to 8 times, okay? So there should not be a number 9 in your list. So as I joke to my exercise ladies, you know, when I'm counting and I'm starting to say 6 and 7, you should be desperately going, thank God she's nearly at number 8. All right? If you can do 9 or 10 or 11 or 12 or 18, that's not a heavy enough weight. Now, there are a lot of restrictions on this, so don't just go home and start. Pure strength training changes your physiology, but that whole process takes 48 hours to complete. So from the moment you've done your 8 bicep curls with your really heavy weights, that sets in process a whole heap of things that are going to take 2 days to fix. So the worst thing you can do with strength training is do it again tomorrow. And that's the good news. You actually only do it. There's actually no evidence to show that 3 times is even better than 2 a week. All right? We usually don't like to discourage you, so we say 3. But 2's fine. Okay? So pure strength training is awesome because it's relatively quick because you're only doing 8 reps of things. You actually do 2 sets. So I don't want you to get lulled into too much of a comfortable situation there. 2 sets twice a week, and you're addressing the muscles. And that's what I said before about getting muscles. If you do this regularly, then you tone up your muscles very quickly. Of course, the challenge is that after a few weeks, or it depends a bit on what the weight is, because everybody starts on baby weights. You don't start by just picking up a 6 kilo weight and thinking, oh yeah, this feels all right. You start with baby weights because you have to sort out things like necks and shoulders and all your other bits first. But when you are lifting your weights, when you start off with a baby weight, you'll actually, you know, increase them fairly quickly because it'll be quite exciting there for a while. But if you're lifting 3 or 4 kilos, it might be 9 months before you change them. But if you just lift that for the next 10 years, you're going to cease to be effective. You have to keep looking at yourself in the mirror and going, more, you know, I can do more than that or less than that. Okay, that's why I'm saying supervision is important. Most of our clients are coming from gyms and stuff where they've had a personal trainer or an exercise person who's had 8 weeks of training going, yep, you're old, should lift weights, boom. And then we're treating necks and shoulders and worst of all, pelvic floor, which is why I'm coming to that. Okay, lots of evidence to show that lymphedema doesn't appear or increase because of your weight lifting. The general feeling about strength training and lymphedema is, this, again, starting gradually and building up gradually is what you're doing. Again, I wouldn't be doing that without some professional help, but but that's not a reason for not doing it. Does that make sense? A bit more about that. So this is a good trial that was done just a couple of years ago. So 300 women, the advice was just to protect the affected arm from overuse, and it was slow progressive strength training, and it actually improved increased the physiologic capacity of the arm, meant it improved the lymphatic drainage. Okay, so it was a good thing to do. All right, and you're actually making it better to do your activities of daily living, and that actually helped again with your arm not sort of going, ugh, I'm doing something different, lymphedema. All right, it's not quite that simple, is it? I love this. This is a lymphedema compression garment. Isn't that awesome? Notice nobody's got one of those. No. Okay. Again, 200 odd postmenopausal breast cancer survivors. The exercise group did strength training twice a week and prevented. They showed at the end that they actually prevented the loss of bone density. So there are in fact two levels of bone density. There's first of all stopping the rot. All right, because remember after menopause we're going to lose bone anyway. So we've got to halt that process. And then the next step, which I'm trying to talk to Melbourne Uni about at the moment, because we've got a whole group of ladies who have been doing weights for a long time, maybe 10, 15 years, and they're getting good bone density results now. Most of the research, they study women for 2 years because it's too expensive to actually monitor them for longer. But, you know, clinically, my reasoning says that if it takes you from 0 to 25 to reach your peak bone mass, it's not a fast process, is it? So our first aim is to prevent the loss, but then if you keep on doing it properly, you should improve that. And with this study, there was no increase in lymphedema anywhere. Okay, this is the gold standard study. Interestingly, it's also an Australian study, but this is the one that's quoted worldwide, that just shows you that these women were all on different exercise things. But the strength training women did much, much better in changing their bone density. Okay, so that was over the people who just walked, which are the fitness people, and the controls did nothing. Okay, one of the reasons this is a gold standard study is because what she did, this woman, this Deb Carr, is she actually did a strength training regime on one side and then she did endurance on the other. So that takes away all your variables. You know, it doesn't matter whether you smoke and how old you are and all that sort of stuff because you're on the same board. So it was quite clever. Okay, just a few examples of flexibility things, you know, making sure you can get your arms over your head. We can do all sorts of interesting things with them. You know, that's just a basic shoulder roll. It's just all these things are designed to be what I call anti-dowager hump things. You know, we ask ourselves to get a dowager's hump because we sit all the time. A lot of you have been mothers, presumably, so you spent many years in this position talking to little people. You know, there are a whole heap of things that conspire against us, so it's about, you know, just sitting up straight and straightening your shoulders and all that sort of thing. Okay, so your diet is your calcium, your vitamin D, no smoking, alcohol. Nicotine actually interferes with calcium absorption. Okay, and too much alcohol, so no more binge drinking. A little bit of alcohol is okay, too much is not. Okay, the biggest problem with osteoporosis is if you fall, you break something. Okay, under the age of 65, if you fall, you're quick enough to get your hand out and you usually break your wrist. But over the age of 65, give or take, you're not quick enough to get your hand out, so you land on your hip and you break your hip. Okay, so I've actually had one lady in my exercise class who's just recently broken her wrist, just before Christmas. And she came in, she said, the first thing I thought of was, I broke my wrist, I didn't break my hip, because she's about 85. So I said, well, that's sort of a good thing, but it'd be good if you hadn't broken your wrist as well. Okay, so the things about falls and falls prevention is that, first of all, you've got to assess the risks, and, you know, any physio should be able to help you do that. But it's about little things like, you know, do you have loose rugs at home? The thing you fall over most in your own home is your pet. And it's not like you don't know they're there, but I must admit I'm guilty of that. I have a dog that likes to sleep on the stairs if there's someone he loves upstairs and someone he loves downstairs. And I've been seen to step down two steps to get over him when I'm thinking, you know, if I fell, that'd be a stupid idiot, I should have just gone, move, Jack. The thing we fall over most outside is actually our own hose. And there was a lot more of that around when we were watering madly as well. And you, again, you're the one that's probably left the hose there. My husband would die laughing if you hear me telling you to be good, because I'm not so good. But it is about packing those things up, okay? From a balance point of view, you have to practice balance every day, all right? Now, it's not hard. You just have to, in fact, stand up. One of the things that affects your balance is your senses, all right? Just stand so you can hang on to something. So for everybody except the front row, you've got a chair. Otherwise, go around behind your chair. Okay. Now, all I want you to do is just go up on your toes for me. All right, but make sure you're hanging on, please. All right, so that's a balance exercise. You can do that every time the kettle's boiling. All right, now before you come down, just close your eyes. Okay, and can you open them and sit down again? Did that make a difference? Okay, sadly, from the age of 35, you depend on your eyesight for balance. All right, so that means that if you're getting up to go to the toilet in the middle of the night and you're not putting on any lights because you don't really want to wake up, and you're bouncing off the walls to get there, yes. See, I know. I've been. If you don't put your glasses on, you're compromising your eyesight. If you're in a place where your eyesight's not crash hot, like one of the things that constantly amazes me is everyone who jumps up and leaves a movie before they turn the lights on. Okay? If you just sit there and watch the credits, I'm probably a bit sensitive about that because I do have someone in the movie industry. I think everyone should watch the credits. But they do actually turn the lights on. You know, you can see where you're going. You don't have to leave in the dark. If you're in a crowd, like you're leaving the footy or something like that, where you can't actually see the escalator because there's someone else here, okay, again, if you just sit there for 3 minutes, everyone will be gone and you'll be okay. So it's about being sensible about what you do. It's making sure if you have grandchildren visiting, for instance, that you pack up before you go to bed. Like if you're going to bounce off the walls to get to the toilet, which you shouldn't, but if you are, you don't want to be tripping over something that you weren't expecting to be there, okay? And little people leave stuff lying around, don't they? One of the things that we've had happen twice to some of our exercise ladies is they've slipped on a magazine that they've chucked out of the bed to go to sleep, and then they've stood up in the middle of the night and slipped on it. Okay, and you sort of think, well, yeah, we all do that, don't we? You just think, oh, I'll go to sleep now and put the thing down. So it's just about thinking and preventing. We know that to prevent falls, you need to have really strong quads, which are your knee muscles. One of the interesting things you can try if you like, if you've got nothing in your hands, just put your feet down. I'm sorry, I did promise you no activity, didn't I? Slide to the edge of the chair where you know, because you're going to stand up in a minute. All right. Now, what I want you to see if you can do is just stand up without using your hands. Excellent. Okay, so that means you're 2 to 3 times less likely to fall than someone who can't do that. Okay, so it's a good little test for your friends. All right, sit down again. And one of the things that I think is a good challenge there is a toilet is actually lower than a chair, and you go into the toilet a few times every day. See if you can get up off the toilet without using your hands, because if you know you can do that, you're actually much safer. All right, that means these muscles are doing enough, but you can always do more. Physios would never tell you you've done enough. And as I said, the balance practice, just little things. Like you don't practice falling over. You don't sort of wobble around. What you do is you do something like you stand on tippy toes at the kitchen bench with the bench there, like you just did for me, and you just stand there for 30 seconds while you're waiting for the kettle to boil. If you're really brave, do it the other way around. Back up to the bench and stand on your heels. Okay, so yeah, I used to be good at this. I haven't practiced it for a while. Okay, and I shouldn't be doing that in the middle of nowhere. But standing on your heels strengthens up all the muscles in the front of your foot. The other thing people fall over is their own feet, all right? And that's because you're not actually lifting your foot through properly enough. So that's actually a really good cheats way of just getting a bit more activity, just a bit more strength in those muscles, okay? When you change shoes, new pairs of shoes, you know, you get used to wearing, you know sort of where you are in space. So changing shoes, you just got to think, okay, these are a tiny bit longer or whatever. All right, so it's just little things. So the two things about preventing falls are the strength of those quads and practicing some balance stuff, okay? All right, now just for osteoporosis, just to finish it off, there are things you shouldn't do, okay? Rapid explosive movements, okay, or this or that or anything. So that's a combination of explosive and twisting. This is if you've really got osteoporosis, okay? You're not going to break if your bones are just getting a bit weaker. Forward flexion is really, 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 really going down into that sort of curly position. High impact, that's running and jumping again, because that, you know, if you've got osteoporosis, this is not about prevention, this is if you have.
What about like my vertigo? I've been told I've got to sit on the edge of the bed and sit up and then
throw yourself about.
Yeah.
But you're doing that, because you're doing that in the safety of a of your bed, right? So, and yeah, you need to fix that because you've got those little crystals, haven't you, in your ears that are, excuse me, just grabbing another lolly. Okay, you don't have to answer these questions out loud, but if you ever rush to the toilet, okay, but some people do this, there are people all over Melbourne who put their key in the front door and are suddenly busting. Sometimes feel you don't empty completely, worry about losing control of your bladder or bowel, there are more. Leak before you get to the toilet, go twice or more at night. Leak if you lift something too heavy or play sport, or have any heaviness or dragging inside at the end of the day. They're all indications of some sort of pelvic floor dysfunction. If you'd asked me before I walked in the door, I would have said probably most of you do, okay? You have some symptoms or another. My job is to tell you that that's not normal and you should be getting it fixed, okay? Do not put up with it. You don't have to. Basically, one in three women who's ever had a baby will have a problem unless she's done something about it. And the Continence Foundation of Australia think that that's the tip of the iceberg because it's not something we're good at talking about, except for people like me. Okay, now, as I just tell you, pelvic floor muscles literally do what they say. They form the floor of that basin that is your pelvis, okay? Then you have other muscles along here, some really deep tummy muscles, and you have some really, really cute little back muscles that run inside here. These are underneath all your Arnie Schwarzenegger big muscles that you see, right? And then you have your breathing muscle on the top. So when you do something with your body, stand up, sit down, bend over, pick up something, when you do something, you have to create some internal abdominal pressure here. So if you've got a weak link, when you laugh or cough or sneeze or stand up, then that weak link gives way and you leak, all right? If it's your tummy, it might be your tummy. So if your tummy's not holding on, then you will also leak because you don't create that sort of pressure. These tummy muscles are right down above that pubic bone, you know, that bridge of bone there. If you put your hand there, all right, now I want you to just sit tall. I want you to imagine that I'm going to, whether or not we're standing, put you in a pair of bikinis. And you want to get rid of a little bit of a muffin top here. So I want you to just gently draw it in. It's not a suck in. It's very, very gentle. Okay? They're your deep abdominals. They work about 30% of their capacity all day. All right? They don't turn off if they work. Okay? Now, if you've been pregnant and you haven't done anything about your tummy much since then in terms of this, they're probably not working properly. All right? And they work with your pelvic floor. So one of the things I want you to go home with today is just thinking about using these muscles, all right, and hopefully inspired to perhaps find out a bit more about them. If these deep tummy muscles work, they actually co-contract with your pelvic floor. So it's a good cheats way of getting, you know, if you are leaking, if you laugh or cough or sneeze, you can pull your tummy in quickly and pull your pelvic floor on and you won't. Okay, it depends how strong or weak the muscles are. All right, it's not quite as simple as I'm painting today, but it's a bit hard to do it in a group. I'm sorry about the activity again. Stand up. Imagine I stuck a helium balloon on the crown of your head. The crown of your head is your official tallest part. So imagine I have a piece of string pulling you up from there. First thing you all did then was you actually straightened up and you turned your tummies on. Right, now that's the amount of effort I'm looking for. So you're thinking tallish and thinnish, or you're thinking helium balloon, and you've solved your problem. You're already doing it. It's not hard. It's just about getting it done. All right, so keep your helium balloons on and sit down.
I've just had breast reconstruction, and they've cut through the kidney artery there. They've cut through all that muscle. What
if that weakened? No, they probably haven't cut through the muscles. No. They might have, like even with a Caesar, what they do is they cut through your skin like that, and then when they're inside, they actually change and they go vertically, so they just separate the muscles, they don't cut them. Yeah, well, you had pain and also, yeah, you had all sorts of other issues, right? I mean, you had pain and probably wasn't. If you couldn't lift your head off the pillow, it might have been a muscle. But if you could lift your head off the pillow, it wasn't your muscles. But you had a lot of wound pain, so that's a different thing, right?
Would that affect your bladder?
Pain. Every time you get pain, your brain turns off the surrounding muscles in case there's more damage, all right? So if you've just broken your leg and it's sticking out of the skin, it's probably good to not have your quads working, right? But if you go back to back pain, for instance, you get some back pain and the first thing your brain does is it turns off all the supporting muscles, you're actually more at risk then than you are. That's just the way the brain works, okay? But we also know from all the research now, which we didn't know a few years ago, that if we don't turn those muscles back on, then they stay off, or they're slow, their timing and recruitment. So muscles need to be strong, they also need to be able to hang on, and they need to time properly, you know, so they need to turn on when you need to. You don't want to be halfway up. Like if you leak, if you laugh or cough or sneeze or do something like that, what's happened is you've gone to raise your intra-abdominal pressure by moving, and then you've started to leak and your brain's gone, oops, forgot the pelvic floor, and then it contracts it and brings it along. All right, so you need, there are ways of fixing that. We'll talk about that. This is just, I'm sorry about the quality of the picture here, but basically these deep abdominals are your corset. They're your flat tummy and your waist, all right? It's not your crunches and curl-ups. They actually are only icing on the cake. If you don't have a cake, you can't put icing on it. So these ones are underneath and much, much more important. And when they contract, your pelvic floor pulls up and that supports you. If these don't contract, then your pelvic floor actually goes down, bears down, and that's even worse than not working, all right? This lady I just put in here, there's actually, if you go onto YouTube, you can find her. This is a weightlifter, I think, at the Olympics before Beijing. Where was that? Anyway, this lady is actually leaking wee as she lifts. 80% of our elite trampolinists at the AIS average age 16 leak. Okay, because high impact stuff is not as good as it's cracked up to be. All right? Coffee, okay. Coffee's a different issue. Coffee is the caffeine, and that has a bladder irritant effect, all right? So it's about understanding how many coffees you can have. But you, if you have to run to the toilet, you can manage that better than you are, all right? I'd get some help. It doesn't have to be from me. There are lots of women's health physios out there, but it's about getting control of your bladder and bowel and learning how to do that. It's not just about strengthening the muscles. It's about lots of other things. So caffeine does affect some people more than others. And, you know, some people make the decision to give up caffeine because of that. Other people think, oh, well, you know, it's going to make me want to go to the toilet, but I'm in a cafe. There's always a toilet in a cafe. I'll be right. You know, and that's a social decision and that's fine, okay? But you need to go through the steps first. All right, so that was just to depress you there, okay? All right. Now, this is an interesting little statistic. It's very trendy to carry your drink bottle everywhere you go these days, but the kidney specialists will tell you that you need 24 meals per kilo of body weight per day unless you've been given some specific instructions about your own health. So for a 70-kilo person, that's about 1,800 mils of fluid other than alcohol, basically. Caffeine actually doesn't have the diuretic effect we used to think it did, which is very exciting for those of us who love coffee. You have to have about 10 cups of coffee to have a diuretic effect. It has the bladder irritative effect. Yeah, but no, it's not actually the diuretic effect that's probably affecting you. It's probably that caffeine bladder irritant thing. We used to think it was like alcohol. You know, if you have a glass of wine, it pulls the water out of your tissue, sticks it in your bladder. That's a diuretic effect. That's like having pills, you know, fluid pills. And that's not necessarily a good thing. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. You know, basic rule with alcohol is for every glass of wine you have or every glass of alcohol you have, you should have a corresponding glass of water. But you should just keep your eyes on that number there, okay? That can include soup and stuff like that. But most of us don't drink enough, give or take the people who wander around with the drink bottles, who are probably drinking too much. All right? So just have a think about that, because the more concentrated your wee, the yellower it goes, and this is a whole different ball game if you're taking vitamins or your pills colour your wee, that's a whole different thing. But if you're just eating a normal diet and you're going to the toilet, a quick check in the loo to see what colour your wee is really useful, because we should actually be the colour of gin, but it's really hard to get it like that, okay? But it should be pale. So the yellower it gets, the more it'll have that caffeine effect of being a bladder irritant. So, you know, I wish I had a dollar for every time someone sits in my rooms and says, well, you know, I've been leaking so I've stopped drinking. And in fact, you're actually making it much more likely that you will leak if you do that, all right? So it's not going to help to stop drinking if you leak. But again, I'm just skating over the top of everything here. There's obviously a lot of depth.
And the lighter it is, the better.
Yeah, the paler. But if you take vitamins or something, they colour wee often. Beetroot does. Have you ever thought you were dying when you had beetroot? Okay, this is Mrs. Textbook again. Okay, normal trips to the toilet, 4 to 6 during the day and 0. Once at night as we get older is quite normal, okay? But if you go more than that, there are lots of other reasons maybe for that and you could get some help. One of the things that we are all bad at is going just in case, and we can all blame our mothers for that, okay? And then her mother taught her to do that, okay? One of the reasons that we go just in case is because once upon a time we didn't used to be good at public toilets. So, and that's quite handy if you're in France where they still don't do public toilets. But the first myth is that you can't catch bugs off a toilet seat, okay? The bugs that live in your system that are likely to be nasty don't like air. They don't like oxygen. They're called anaerobic bugs. So the moment they hit the air, they die, okay? Millisecond, dead. So you can't catch anything off a toilet seat. So number one, which isn't on my thing, but you shouldn't ever hover over a toilet, okay? You need to sit on it. If you don't want to sit on it, then do creative things with toilet paper. Because when you hover, you change where your bladder is in your bowel, in your body, and you actually don't usually empty at all, which makes you much more prone to urinary tract infections and stuff like that. No, a lot of you do, okay? I'm not just picking on you. The don't go just in case is partly because your mother didn't want to be, you know, arriving wherever you went and you saying, I want to go to the toilet. And I'm sure we've all been guilty of that. The only time you can go just in case is just before bed, all right? If you get into bed and you haven't been to the toilet, you're going to sit there going, do I want to go? No, I don't. Yes, I do. No, I don't. You're going to wait 20 minutes and then you're still going to go. So total waste of sleeping time. But for every other occasion, you say to yourself, do I need to go? Like when you leave here, probably you'll all think you need to go because we've been talking about it, and that also puts that power suggestion there. But basically, if you went to the loo before we started talking, and that was only an hour and a quarter ago, I better hurry up, an hour and a quarter ago, you shouldn't need to go again now, okay? Bladders like to fill up until you they're full and then go. They don't like to go. Like what happens when your bladder gets to about half full, it starts sending you little signals saying, you know, we're filling up down here. You know, you'll need to go to the toilet soon. But most of us put those first few urges off because we don't need to, you know, it doesn't suit. Like if I felt like going to the toilet now, I can say, well, no, it doesn't really suit. I can't say, excuse me, I'm going. So what happens is that if you empty your bladder when it's only half full, it starts thinking, well, hold on a tick, she thought that was full, so I better warn her a bit earlier because that wasn't time enough, right? So then your bladder starts, instead of warning you at 200 mils, it warns you at 150. And then it warns you at 100. Then it warns you at 50. And you're suddenly sitting in my rooms going to the toilet 23 times a day with next to nothing when you get there. It's very easy to give your bladder bad habits. It's not good to practice your pelvic floor exercises, stopping and starting. Finding your pelvic floor in the toilet by trying to stop the flow of urine is useful, but only just to find out that you can do it. There's no magic test that tells you it's strong. Stopping the flow of wee doesn't give us any guide to how strong it should be, so it's a waste of time doing that. But if you want to do that to just go home and think about what I've said, then that's a good test, but don't practice there, all right? And most of us girls spend too much time not taking enough time. We're just in and out. Back to the no just in case as well. As I said, it dates back to when we didn't have public toilets. Most of your tax dollars are going, not most, but some of your tax dollars are going to the National Continence Management Strategy, which comes from Canberra. And that's because this is our other major public health issue. We can't afford for people to be incontinent. The 60% of all nursing home admissions relate to continence. Your family will look after you for ages if you go potty, but as soon as you spring a leak, they're going to go, no. Okay? So that's avoidable. You don't need to be in a nursing home just because you're incontinent, because you should have managed that. Okay. So the National Continence Management Strategy has actually gone to funding all our councils to provide decent public toilets. So you can walk into the depths of the Fitzroy Gardens and find a clean public toilet with toilet paper. There may not be soap and there may not be a dryer, but there should be a clean toilet and toilet paper. And, you know, I think I've got the only husband who can walk out of, you know, the toilet in Swan Hill and go, I'd give that an 8. Yeah, okay. The things that my family have to do. So you should be safe in knowing that if you need a toilet, there is one. If you go onto the CFA website and look up public toilet map, you can find every single public toilet in Australia. So you can actually plot your way around Oz. Or any journey. So for some people that is really important. Like if you can't be away from the toilet for much time, you need to know where everyone is. So it's too big a document to print, but you can print bits of it, obviously. So if you're going from here to Coffs Harbour, you can print the bits you need. But, I mean, one of the advantages of living in Melbourne with all our cafes is that you can't have a food establishment unless there's a toilet. So you can always duck into a cafe, you can order a coffee, go to the loo, come back. McDonald's always have clean toilets. You know, there should be plenty of toilets around now. So that shouldn't be an issue, that just in case thing. Okay, so just back to good bladder and bowel. Good position, so sitting on the toilet. Remember, how's your helium balloon going? Is it still on? Oh, I didn't think so. It should still be on. So the important point about that is that if you have your tummy switched on and that then contracts your pelvic floor, if you go and sit on the toilet for either bowels or bladder and then you tighten your tummy to push, you've just shut the door, haven't you, when you wanted to open it. Okay, so pooing becomes an issue. All right, if you strain on the toilet, you're actually making it worse, because if you're straining, you're using your tummy muscles, and your tummy muscles make your pelvic floor tighten. Your pelvic floor is wrapped around Uranus. It's going to shut the door when you want to relax it. So if you're having issues in that department, you should get some help from a women's health physio as well. You need to make sure you've got enough fluids on board, enough soluble fibre, not just all brand type fibre. The best fibre is actually fruit and veggies. 5 veggies, 2 fruits a day. Exercise. If you're not exercising, your bowels don't work so well. All right, so that's an issue, you know, if you're having treatment and all sorts of other things, but that lack of exercise actually slows everything down. And sometimes it's as simple as doing laps around the ward or getting out and, you know, going up and down your street or something like that. You know, it depends how well you are and where you're at, but there are ways of doing that, all right? And then obviously medications make a difference. The opioids and all those things are constipating. Okay, just there you are. There's your pubic bone, which is this bridge of bone here. That's your tailbone down there. That's your bowel. That's your uterus. That's your bladder. And there's your pelvic floor under there. Okay? So it actually, like you can see that your urine pipe runs through your pelvic floor, your vagina runs through your pelvic floor, and so does your rectum down there. So all those bits, you use your pelvic floor as a secondary tap. There's another tap for those as well, but the secondary tap's the one you need when you're busting, when your bladder's full. Okay, just pop these last few slides in to just talk about Pilates, for instance. One of the real Pilates is awesome, and it's really awesome for cancer survivors. It's really awesome for pelvic floor issues, but it can be really badly done. So I just wanted to draw your attention. There's Pilates and then there's clinical Pilates. Clinical Pilates is actually Pilates that's actually done by physios first who have then trained to do Pilates rather than just Pilates instructors. Pilates instructors are like fitness instructors. They do courses and they learn recipes and off they go. But you're not functioning to a recipe. You all have different needs, different abilities. But Pilates is functional exercise. So it uses scary looking equipment, but if you're in a clinical Pilates group, you wouldn't even be working that. The physio would be doing that for you. But it actually helps your brain figure out what's normal and what's not. So it's about shortcuts, if you like. If you imagine that your brain is... your brain's like your desktop on your computer, okay? Well, your brain, you've got the front part of your brain, which is your desktop, and then the rest of your brain. So when you click on your desktop to open a file on a shortcut, the computer still steps through all its bits, doesn't it? But you've only had one click. So when you say stand up to yourself, you don't sit there and think, oh, I need neck, I need back, I need tummy, I need pelvic floor, I need ankle, I need toe. If you did that, you'd never go anywhere, would you? But so your brain uses millions and millions of shortcuts to do everything. They're called motor pathways. And you've got good motor pathways in there, but things change that, like surgery, pain, pregnancy, sitting at a desk, like a myriad of things will make your brain choose a different pathway. Pilates should train you back into the pathways that are good, that are functional. Roger Federer was the first person to do Pilates in the tennis world. When we watch Roger Federer play tennis, we actually say, gee, he makes it look easy, doesn't he? I'm sure if we asked him, he'd probably tell us it wasn't easy at all, but he's using his baby or even his body functionally. Geelong Footy Club, just before they became good, started doing Pilates. They were the first AFL club to start it as part of their regular routine. It's just another group of things that one should think about doing. It's not a substitute for cardiovascular fitness. It's not a substitute for your strength training, but it's an awesome thing to do. If you find a good Pilates person who understands your problems or your challenges, then you will love it. And it's a really, really good thing to do. And you, to make it effective, you really only need to do it once a week. So it's about concentration, it's about awareness, it's about control, and it's about breathing. And by breathing, I just mean normal breathing. I don't mean you breathe in on the way in and you breathe out on the way out, you know, or those sorts of things. If you have to do an exercise that has breathing built into it like that, like you breathe in on this and breathe out on that, I know yoga does that and it's slightly different in yoga, but for something functional, like all she's doing there is moving this platform by pulling on those. So when she pulls on those and she does that, she actually slides a bit. So that's actually immediately unsteadying and your brain goes, whoa, don't like this much. So your brain figures out which of these core muscles it needs to keep you still. All right, so you don't get up a sweat when you do this. But if you had to, if we made Ness there, that was Ness in her pregnant days, but if we made Ness breathe in, say, when she's going that way and then breathe out when she's going that way, then her brain's learning that you have to tie breathing to movement, and that's dumb. Like, we don't do that, do we? We don't. Imagine if we had to walk around all day thinking, do I breathe in now? Do I breathe out now? Any of you who've had asthma will know that it's very tiring if you have to think about breathing. You're not supposed to do that. It's supposed to be automatic. So breathing is about just behaving normally, if you like. Okay. So Pilates does lots of good things. It makes your tummy muscles better. It makes your pelvic floor muscles better. It makes you up straighter. It helps with that nice posture. How's the helium balloon? It does give you greater flexibility because any exercise is going to do that. And it makes you much... like, one of the big things here is it takes away your likelihood of getting backache because you're using all the right muscles. Okay, so what you've got to do is fit it into your exercise plan somehow or find out where to do it. The thing that I think is really useful, that if you're not well enough for something more vigorous or you're going through a stage where you're not, then something like this is really good, okay, because it's still keeping you moving. It's enough for the bowels and things like that. It can be modified on a day-to-day basis according to how you're feeling. And we have lots of ladies who are struggling a bit on a breast cancer journey who just turn up every week to do things like that. Okay, so you can do mat work stuff, you can use equipment, like that's a roller thing, you can use balls or all those other bits. But just second last slide, I think what you need to do is sort of go home and have a think about what your needs are, what you're going to be able to fit in, all right, and going from there. So you actually sort of start thinking, as I said before, I'm very pragmatic, you can't do everything all at once. It's a case of trying to think of something that appeals to you. I mean, and that's the other thing that I haven't talked about, but if you're not interested in it, it won't work. Okay, so someone can tell you you should try swimming or you should try that, but if you're sitting there thinking, oh, I don't want to get my hair wet and don't want to have a shower, and you're never going to stick at it, okay? You have to find something you enjoy, whether it's the social aspect. Like, I have a whole heap of ladies who come and exercise every Monday and Wednesday at 7:30 in the morning. And most of the time I tell them it's because they're just waiting for breakfast afterwards because I think they all go and have breakfast. But that's okay. You know, they come and do their exercises. And so that's made it a pleasurable experience. But if you don't like what you're doing and you're doing it because you think you should, it's not going to work. So you need to find something or get some help finding something that appeals to you. And you're like, oh, we're all different. We all like doing different stuff. Okay? And I'm finished. Okay? Sorry about all that. Yeah, I hung in, which is really amazing.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.